this isn't just any podcast. This is the Historically Inaccurate Podcast, all the way from Hampshire.
I do not sound like that.
You kind of do a little bit.
Do you know, sometimes a girl can get a bit of a complex sometimes.
Good morning, everyone, and happy Easter. Our podcast today is brought to you by four friends, two Scots, a Greek and an English Rose, who like to chat about history. You are invited to listen, enjoy and spread the news of this social experiment taking place in your ears whilst we entertain you. So, hello, my friends. This is Marianne, I'm your host today, and welcome to the third episode of our show. This is a special one dedicated to the magical city of Edinburgh, and we've got Kelly.
Hello, everyone.
We've got Becky.
Hi.
And of course, we've got Cam.
Hello.
Yeah. So we'll start today with Cam introducing us to the timeline of Edinburgh, followed by Becky's favourite history of Edinburgh and Kelly's This Is Your Inaccurate History segment. Okay. So we promise to remain historically inaccurate throughout, and Cam, please go ahead and start.
Cheers, Maria. Thank you very much. So, the earliest settlement that's been found within the Edinburgh region is a Mesolithic settlement, which is dated from 8500 BC near Crammond. It's also been found that there have been other Bronze and Iron Age sites that have also been found near Arthur's Seat and in and around Edinburgh Castle. Now, apologies, I'm going to have to jump about 8,000 years because I couldn't find much between 8,500 BC and 100 AD, so tough that, shit.
That was when the aliens came, so, you know, there's a lot of, like, secretiveness during that period.
And you the haggis were roaming the hills as well.
Oh, yeah, the wild haggis.
Oh, yes.
Okay, between 8,500 BC and 100 AD, there was aliens and wild haggis roaming the hills around Edinburgh. So, we then have the Romans that invade, and they decide to also build a fort at Crammond. It's at this point they make contact with one of the Celtic tribes known as the Vaut Adini, which is in the 1st century AD. Now, it's interesting because the Vaut Adini, their capital, was located at, I believe it's called Trapinlaw Hill Fort, which is in East Lothian, until it was abandoned at some point in the 5th century, in which case they moved to Edinburgh, known as Dun Edin. Before the 7th century, there was another tribe, the Gododin, who are believed to be the descendants of the Vaut Adini, who built a hill fort known as Dun Edin in the area of modern-day Edinburgh. However, we are unsure if this was the foundations of Edinburgh Castle, as there are a couple of locations that it could possibly be this actual fort. So it could be at Calton Hill, or it could possibly be, at Arthur's Seat. Now, it's also interesting, in the epic Welsh poem, Ye Gododin, I don't know if that's how you say it, but anyway, Edinburgh Castle is first possibly mentioned as a stronghold of Eldin. So Eldin was a region attributed to Edinburgh. So we fast forward a couple of hundred years, and in the 6th and 7th century, there are invasions by the Angles of Northumberland, such as King Oswald, who is believed to have besieged Edinburgh in 638 AD and took control of the Lothian region by the 650s. This is quite significant, as it led to this part of Scotland coming under the influence of a Saxon kingdom, which would ultimately also influence language and culture. At the Battle of Nectismere in 685, this was between a king known as Bridie MacBilly, or as I call him, Big Bridie, beating the Northumbrian king, Ecgfrith. This meant that Edinburgh was now the most northerly settlement of the Northumbrians, because previously the Northumbrians had actually pushed further north into Scotland. But by the time Big Bridie comes along and beats that Geordie, that's pretty much it.
Is that where, like, the food Bridie comes from? The wonderful Scottish meat pastry that is just très bien.
I definitely think so. It's got to be. I mean, there's no other mention of Bridie in the history of Scotland bar Bridie McBilly and a Bridie at Stephen's Bakery. Not that I'm advertising them, but I'm just saying they are pretty good.
Yeah, well, it seems that I think that is one thing that we have learned so far is that the Bridie comes from Bride. What was his name? Bridie McBrider, sound?
Bridie McBilly, the Pictish King. Yeah, definitely. I mean, I'm sure. I mean, they must have had Bridies in the, you know, in the Dark Ages. So definitely.
What's in a Bridie? I don't.
Yes, me neither.
Kelly, you take this one.
How would you describe it as being different from a sausage roll? Is it got like, I think it's got like onions and stuff through it as well?
It's
or is it a different
like,
part of meat? Is it different meat? I don't actually know.
I mean, it really kind of depends, because I remember when I was studying at Dundee, like I remember having a Bridie with like mincemeat and onions in it. It was almost kind of like a Cornish pasty kind of, if you will. But essentially, it's like having an orgasm, just only Scottish.
Oh, yeah.
It is just like orgasm. Sublime.
Oh my god!
Oh, so apparently, this is what it says on the all knowledgeable Wikipedia, which is, as we all know, is very accurate. It is a pastry with minced steak, butter, and beef suey.
Oof!
That sounds very posh to be a Scottish thing. Oh, it's fat. It's just a posh word for fat. So yeah, it's pretty much just like an extra fatty sausage roll because that's how we like to do things in Scotland. I was going to say medieval shout Scotland, out. Like that bit out of Horrible Histories, but it didn't work.
Shout out Horrible Histories.
So the influence of the Northumbrian dialect of Old English therefore gave us the term borough, or burr, which subsequently became borough, and Edinburgh was known as Edwin's Borough. Meaning
sorry to interject. I really hope that our American friends, listeners, can hear that because they tend to go Edinburgh.
Borough.
Oh, borough.
Borough.
It's not hard. It's not hard to pronounce it. I don't get it.
One note. See, okay. So, in fairness to our American Canadian cousins, right? I don't say Edinburgh. I say Edinburgh.
At interchange between the two, like I can say either. Sometimes unconsciously, but both are like fine, just not borough. Like,
yes. Or burr.
And then, yeah, but some, I've heard some people say Glasgow. Like, how can you mispronounce Glasgow? Like, Glasgow? Like, no. Yeah.
Seriously.
Yeah. Like, oh, just wait until they see Hoik and, like, can you say
it? Right, okay. The first 6 years of my life in Scotland, I was calling it Howick.
Classic Becky, brilliant. Actually, here's one. Echo Feckin.
That is such a good name.
Okay, so the influence of the Northumbrian dialect of Old English therefore gave us Borough, and Edwin's Borough, meaning Edwin's town. Edwin was a king of Northumberland from 616 to 633. Another interesting fact is King Edwin is also a saint, and he is the saint of hobos. So,
I mean, should we be offended on behalf of Edinburgh that their saint is the saint of hobos?
He's not really the saint of Edinburgh, he's just the, you know, I mean, this is the thing, though. It's actually quite interesting. So when I've been doing my research, I've been really trying to find out if Edinburgh is named after King Edwin or if it's taken from the old Brythonic Dun Edain.
Yeah, I always thought it was descended from the Celtic tribe.
See, this is the thing, though. Like, I mean, I've been speaking to, I mean, I know they're not, like, the greatest authority, but mum and, sorry, Dad, Gran, I love you very dearly. But my dad has always basically maintained, and this was always my kind of understanding as well, and from what I kind of read, that Edinburgh got its name from Edwin, the king of Northumberland, and then Borough to mean an old kind of like English version for a settlement. But I do know that Dun Edain and Dun Edain, you know, is, subsequently as it is in Gaelic as well, are also quite... I mean, they're also used as well. So I'm not actually sure, if I'm being perfectly honest. So, listeners, I do apologise.
It's a very long time ago. It'd be hard to know for sure, to be fair.
But we can all take comfort in the fact that if any of us become a hobo, we can always pray to Saint King Edward.
Aww.
Aww. So, during the 10th century, the Vikings began raiding, and the Danelaw, which was a time when Danish laws superseded Anglo-Saxon laws and led to a period of domination by the Danes in England. This led to the province of Northumbria to be cut off from the rest of England, thereby weakening it. During this time, it would appear Edinburgh and the surrounding area would come under the control of the Kingdom of Scotland, and in the Chronicle of the Kings of Alapa, they record that Edinburgh had been evacuated and abandoned to the Scots. So, Edinburgh had been seceded to the Scots between 954 AD and 962. In 973, the English king, King Edgar the Peaceful, grants Lothian to Kenneth II, King of Scots. And by the early 11th century, the Scottish hold over Edinburgh is finally secured with King Malcolm II's victory at the Battle of Carham in 1018. In 1124, construction begins on St. Giles' Church, which is now a cathedral. And in 1130, King David I establishes the town of Edinburgh as one of Scotland's earliest royal boroughs. In this, he also establishes localities in the borough of the Canongate, which is now known as the Royal Mile.
Or the High Street, if you're local. Shout out to my granda, who always called it that.
I've known it as the High Street as well. I mean, I don't really know many people from Edinburgh that don't call it the High Street, but just in case, you know, Edinburgh, let's go to the Royal Mile. I mean, that's not a very good American accent, but that's what I imagine Americans would say, you know. Oh, my God, I can't believe it. Like that, you know. Oh, my God, there's a castle. Oh, my God, I wonder if there's a queen in there. And it's just like, you know.
Do you know what the fringe?
Do you know what the worst bit is? Have you ever seen that thing? And it was like someone, remember that, was it the Vodafone building on Princes Street? No. And it had a big, massive picture of the castle on the side of it.
Oh my God,
and there was
yes.
people getting
people
their photos
get
taken
of
next
that.
To
it. Oh my God, yes.
And the
yes.
castle's right there. The real thing is right there. Just look to your right. Oh.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. So, anyway, Edinburgh was then in the hands of the English, however, for most of the time during the Scottish Wars of Independence. In 1291, and 1314, and from 1333 to 1341.
Shout out to my English forefathers, yeah.
There you go, raping and pillaging, motherfucker. So,
oh my God.
We're all very good friends. This is a disclaimer for the audience.
Yeah, no, we are, genuinely.
We like each other, really.
So, yeah.
Deep down.
So, we then have Edward Baliol, who was the English backclaimant to the Scottish throne, and he gives Edward III, who's the King of England at this particular moment in time, large portions of the southern Scotland, including Edinburgh, as part of the Treaty of Newcastle. So, this is also very interesting as well. So, this is also the time that the port of Leith begins to prosper. So, Berwick had been the main trading port, and due to its occupation by the English, trade had to then be rerouted through Edinburgh via Leith. Kelly, I think you have an interesting point about Berwick.
Yeah, it's just because it's just from working in the borders a couple of years ago I heard about this. So when Berwick went to the English, like you'd mentioned, Berwick was one of the most important ports in Scotland and in towns, like trading towns in general. And when that went to the English, it properly decimated the border. So I know everyone will probably have heard of the Highland Clearances, but there was a thing called the Borders Clearances as well, which isn't really quite as well known, where all of the important border settlements that relied on Berwick didn't have that resource anymore because it was taken over. So, like, for example, like the towns of Roxburgh was completely decimated. People had to leave and, like, move elsewhere, so basically that kind of decimated their entire way of life, and the border clans had to like leave the area. So that was just quite a wee, just thought I'd come in there, just be talking about it moving to Leith. So
very interesting. I didn't actually know that. I had known that there had been clearances in the borders as well, but I didn't realise that was one of the kind of like the main factors of it. So there we go, good to know. So As this happens, Leith continues to be the main port in Scotland for many years to come until the advent of the Empire, and subsequently Glasgow takes over eventually. Now, in 1437, Edinburgh is proclaimed the capital of Scotland and it now holds the royal court. Previously, it was Scone or Scone to our friends in England.
Well, it just depends where you're from.
It just reminded me all of the when me and Becky used to discuss it about the scone versus scone debate.
And the jam versus cream or cream versus jam.
Oh.
Yeah.
This is, to people who don't care, this is not important. But to people who do care, this is actually quite important. And even to some people that don't care, who pretend they don't care, but actually they do care because they fight their corner quite seriously. You know, it's a nationally important question.
It is. No, it's very true, though. It's like when you go to the chippy and you get, let's say, like, you know, like a fish and chips, right? And you get either salt and sauce, salt and brown sauce, chippy brown sauce, that is, or you get salt and vinegar. Now, if I was going out with a lassie and she asked for salt and vinegar,
I'd
fucking ditch her.
Seriously, guys, you're so cruel. I always ask for, like, vinegar.
Oh, no, it's sauce, chippy sauce all the way or nothing.
Can you not have salt? Sorry, can you not have salt, vinegar and brown sauce, or is that just ridiculous?
Where did you start smoking crack?
I go to this, there's this chippy in Pitlochry, right, because it's very much like an East Coast, like Edinburgh and East Coast thing, because there's a chippy in Pitlochry, and the reason I go to this chippy is because it does chippy sauce. And whenever I go in, because he offers you salt and vinegar, but then he'll say, but I know that he's got the wee stash of chippy sauce under there for people that come from the East. So, like, whenever I go in, and he's like, salt and vinegar, and I just look at him and I'm like, salt and sauce, please, and then he goes, you East Coast hooligan.
Oh, wow.
But it knows, like, I don't know why it does that every single time, because it knows that I take, salt and sauce is
where it's
at. He wants
to out you to the local populace, being like, she's an East Coaster.
With all due respect, I'd rather be from the East Coast than the West Coast. I know, but, you know, it's kind of like, we'd rather have, you know, an accent like, for example, mine or Kelly's, or would you rather have the kind of, you know, the cone head slash, I don't know, you know, all right, mate, how's it going? Like that, you know, it's just...
Oh, no, man!
It's so thespian you are.
I've got mates from Glasgow and stuff like that, like, you know, they're nice guys, it's just I can't listen to them for too long. You know, it's a jokey thing, you know what I mean? People from Glasgow, if you listen to this, you'll probably think I'm an arsehole, but then, yeah, that's fine.
He's not.
So, but they'd
not.
Say the same about us. It's like a love, we love, it's a love thing, really. It's just like a, you know, yeah.
No, it's not. It's really not. I fucking hate them. jokes. I'm only joking. No, I really do. It's all right. It's grand. So, anyway, if you don't mind, I should be moving on. So, Edinburgh was almost destroyed in 1544 by an English army led by Lord Hertford. This would then become known as the Burning of Edinburgh. Now, this is quite interesting, I thought. This was a large part due to Henry VIII of England's wish to either subjugate Scotland or join it with England. And a funny fact about this is the war between 1542 and 1551, which includes the Burning of Edinburgh, was known as the Rough Wooing. Not quite sure what kind of fucking wooing he was trying to do, but there you go.
Was that not when he was wanting his son to marry Mary Queen of Scots?
Yes, yeah. It didn't fucking work out.
And they were like, no, and then he was like, and that was when he's meant to have said, I will raise Edinburgh to the ground to get them to marry, but obviously. Which he did. Well, he attacked. I don't know how much he raised it to the ground, but
yeah. I mean, all I kind of got was it was almost destroyed. So I'm going to assume maybe, I don't know, they left a couple of houses and probably a church and just went, fuck it, that's it. Let's go back home, lads. We'll go wooing somewhere else. So Edinburgh then plays a leading role in the establishment of the Reformation. This is notable as John Knox, who is everyone's favourite kind of Renaissance Abu Bakr preached at St. Giles' Cathedral against Mary, Queen of Scots, during her reign, advocating for her execution as an adulteress, murderess, and a papist. So, another interesting fact that I found out as well was the last person to be executed for blasphemy was a guy by the name of Thomas Aikenhead, who was a 20-year-old resident of Edinburgh who studied at Edinburgh University. So his crime was that he ridiculed the Holy Scriptures, calling the Old Testament Ezra's fables, in profane allusion to Aesop's fables, he railed on Christ, saying he learned magic in Egypt, which enabled him to perform pranks, which were called miracles. That he called the New Testament the history of imposter Christ. And as such, Thomas was hung in 1692. On that delicate note, then the University of Edinburgh was established in 1583 by the Edinburgh Town Council and established as a royal charter by King James VI, who, as we all know, is a wank, in 1582. In 1612, Greyfriars Kirk, the original kind of building, began construction in 1612 and opened in 1620. Edinburgh was occupied by Oliver Cromwell's Commonwealth forces during the English Civil War in 1640, and in 1645, Edinburgh experienced a deadly plague during which tens of thousands died. Now, moving on, we have in 1706 and 1707, the Acts of Union were passed by the Parliaments in England and Scotland, and subsequently the Parliament then moved down to England. The Faculty of Medicine at the University of Edinburgh, which is formed in 1726, raised funds for the construction of the Royal Infirmary of Edinburgh, with work beginning in 1738 and finishing in 1741. In 1745, Edinburgh was briefly occupied by the Jacobite army before their march south to England, and then before they got their arse handed to them at Culloden. The town council in Edinburgh then was quite keen on reaffirming Scotland and Edinburgh's loyalty to the Union, and in an attempt to copy London, began the process of expanding Edinburgh. So this is probably about the time that the new town starts to kind of like the ideas start coming across and it starts getting built. And you find that in the new town, names such as George Street, Hanover Street, Frederick Street were chosen in favour of the Hanoverian royal family. In 1754, the Royal Exchange, now known as Edinburgh City Chambers, was built and completed in 1761. By the 1760s, the old town had fallen out of favour with the business classes in Edinburgh, and with the construction of the new town beginning in 1767, and a subsequent second new town was designed and built and completed in the 1830s. This meant that all the kind of like the yuppies of the 18th century left the old town and went to the new town. Gentrification even back then. Interesting fact, Bute House, the official residence of the First Minister of Scotland, was part of this new development in the new town. Located in Charlotte Square, it was to be grander than the other properties in the vicinity and was built in 1790. Now, a very interesting fact about this, and it's something that, I think most people should really know about the role of slavery and the history of slavery in Britain and the kind of establishment within the empire, but often kind of feel though that, like, I don't know about you guys, but certainly for myself, we didn't really cover it at high school.
No, not at all. We never.
Becky, what about yourself?
To be honest with you, the first I really delved into the history of slavery within the UK and the empire was when I did two semesters of the history of slavery at university. But in terms of learning it at schools, there really wasn't, like, I had no idea at all. So yeah, you're probably right there. There's not that much about it in schools at all.
I think it's quite a sad fact, because something I mean, knowing about even the history of Dundee and certain Liverpool as well, you know, these two cities, you know, a lot of the grand works and kind of like buildings were really kind of funded by slavery. And I just kind of think it is something that perhaps should be highlighted more in kind of schools, and I think it should be kind of brought up. Anyway, so back to Bute House. So the first occupant of Bute House was a man by the name of John Innes Crawford, whose great wealth was derived from slavery, specifically Belfield, which was a sugar plantation in Jamaica. So that was something that I found quite interesting. By the 1800s, traditional industries such as brewing in Edinburgh still continued to grow. And subsequently, there was little industrialisation compared with other cities such as Glasgow, which meant by 1821, Glasgow had become Scotland's largest city and effectively Scotland's largest port as well due to Atlantic trade with North America. So in 1828, William Burke and William Hare, the infamous, body snatchers, are arrested, and William Burke is executed in 1829 for murder.
Can I just jump in a wee bit there? Have you ever heard of the the children's skipping rhyme that goes along with the Burke and Hare case?
No.
I have not.
This is, my granda told me this. This is like a sort of, it was like a Edinburgh children's skipping rhyme. Now, I'm really sorry if I do it wrong, but I hope I can remember it because it's just on the top of my head. It was up the close and down the stair, but and Ben with Burke and Hare. Burke's the butcher, Hare the thief, Knock's the man that buys the beef.
Hey!
Wow.
That's what they used to sing when they did their skipping. That's in the borough.
Wow. That's pretty cool.
It is. That's actually really good.
A little bit of local knowledge for you there.
So there we go. So interesting enough, after William Burke is executed in 1829 for murder, the UK Parliament passed the Anatomy Act of 1832, which authorised the dissection of bodies from workhouses unclaimed after 48 hours. It also ended the practice, or attempted to end the practice, I should say, of doctors and medical students having to buy bodies and instead allowed them freer access to donated ones. So on the subject of brewing, I thought this was a very interesting fact as well, considering it's one of my favourite beers and one of the most notable breweries that still exist in Edinburgh today and still brews is that of Caledonian Brewery, founded in 1869, which brews Duker's IPA and Duker's 80 Shilling, both fantastic beers. Not that I'm, you know, advertising, but they are really, really nice. During this time and during this period, the dynamics of Edinburgh city centre change. Prince Street and George Street now become commercial and shopping districts, which is partly due to the advent of the railways in the 1840s. As I kind of previously mentioned in the 1700s, the old town became much, much poorer. And in the 19th century, we see this again. The old town continued to essentially become dilapidated, slums began to kind of crop up. There was high mortality rates. And interestingly enough, some of the kind of like the more, not upmarket places, but kind of more fun places, if you will, of Edinburgh, such as the Grass Market, the Cowgate, the Lawn Market, these are where the slums really existed. The Grass Market, interestingly as well, that I've kind of found out, largely still had slum housing, apparently even up until the 1940s, which is something that I found quite interesting. And on the subject of the Cowgate, in 1865, Alexander Smith, a notable Scottish poet, wrote of the Cowgate. The Cowgate is the Irish portion of the city. Edinburgh leaps over it with bridges. The inhabitants are morally and geographically the lower orders. They keep to their own quarters and seldom come up to the light of day. Many an Edinburgh man has never set his foot in the street. The condition of the inhabitants is little known to respectable Edinburgh, as are the habits of moles, earthworms, and the mining population.
And I will have much more about the Cowgate later on in the podcast.
So, in the same year, major street improvements begin in the old town with the passing of an act as well, the Edinburgh City Improvement Act of 1867, which did bring about the fall in the death rate along with slum clearances. However, the lack of new housing meant that people were forced into already overcrowded existing tenements in other parts of the city. So, congratulations again, Edinburgh City Council. In 1874, Heart of Midlothian Football Club is founded, and in 1875, the Hibernian Football Club is also founded as well. Now we move on to the 20th century, and the First World War breaks out. Edinburgh was bombed on the night of the 2nd to the 3rd of April 1916. Two German Zeppelins dropped high explosive and incendiary bombs on, among other places, Leith, the Mound, Lothian Road. I believe they attempted Edinburgh Castle and the Grass Market as well, which subsequently resulted in 11 civilian deaths, numerous injuries, and a lot of property damaged as well. Owing to its comparative lack of industry, Edinburgh was not targeted as part of the German bombing campaign in the Second World War. The port of Leith, however, was hit on the 22nd of July 1940 when a £1,000 bomb fell on the Albert Dock, though it is unclear whether the original intended target had been the well-defended Rosyth Dockyard, which, as far as I was aware, Scapa Flow, if I remember correctly, was one of the big northern naval bases, but Rosyth was still pretty big as well. Bombs were dropped on at least 11 other occasions between 1940 and July 1942 in what appear to have been opportunistic attacks by bombers jettisoning the remaining load whilst returning from the main target, e.g. either Clydebank or Belfast. So therefore the city escaped major loss of life and damage during the war and emerged from it almost completely unscathed. Now, a bit of my own kind of history here. So my gran, God rest her soul, I remember her actually mentioning to me that when she was young, she was old enough to remember the Second World War. And I remember her telling me that she was actually carried to an Anderson shelter or to a bomb shelter. And I always remember her telling me that apparently the Germans also tried to bomb the Fourth Rail Bridge. I don't think they were successful, not as far as I'm aware anyway, but yeah, so just a little bit about that. So, during the later half of the 20th century, like many parts of the UK, Edinburgh saw massive slum clearances and the building of social housing. In 1947, the first Fringe Festival takes place, much to the chagrin of the inhabitants of Edinburgh, who will forever be plagued by thespians and yuppies in the month of August.
Except for this year, obviously.
Thank fuck for that. So, in most recent history, Scottish devolution in 1997 saw the building of the Scottish Parliament in Holyrood, completed in 2004 to the tune of £414 million.
Not worth it.
Nope, not at all. I've done a mathematic calculation, and based on the population of Scotland at that point, what the government could have done is they could have given every person in Scotland a £50 note to wipe their arse with. I think that would have been a better sense.
I like the Parliament building. I'm just going to go out there and say that I'm like sticking up for it. I think it's nice.
It's quite unique, actually.
It's a concrete mess.
Yeah. And I like how there's different woods from like different parts of Scotland. It incorporates all of the different industries. You know what? I'm going to defend it on record. I think they did a good job.
I second Kelly on that one. And like the mixture of old and new is, I think, what makes Edinburgh so unique, because if you go in the area of Kew Mile near the Meadows, you see all this beautifully done, like sort of like castle like buildings in between glass ones. And although I would never choose to live in a glass one, the difference, the opposition between the two is magical. And it's what it's the city of fireworks for me. It's amazing. It's magical. Edinburgh can do no wrong.
With you saying that, Maria, I've got a quote that is, I actually noted it down, even though it's not, it's just a sort of general quote about Edinburgh, but I loved it so much, and I think this is like my favourite quote that's ever been said about Edinburgh. And it was from your own good countrywoman, Charlotte Bronte, Becky, although she's from Yorkshire, or she was from Yorkshire, so...
Well, I mean, my granddad was as well, so I'm going to take that.
Okay, that's me. So this is what she said in a letter to a friend about Edinburgh. So she said, "My dear sir, do not think that I blaspheme when I tell you that your great London, as compared to Dunedin, mine own romantic town, is as prose compared to poetry, or as a great, rumbling, rambling, heavy epic compared to a lyric, brief, bright, clear, and vital as a flash of lightning."
Oh my god.
Gosh,
I just love that.
That's
beautiful.
It is beautiful. It's the truth.
Sorry, I just want to say one thing. I get totally where you're all coming from, like, especially Maria and Kelly, about, you know, it's new building and stuff like that. I just kind of feel, though, that, like, £440 million for something like that, when you've kind of got the old Parliament building as well, which you could have kind of revamped, perhaps for a fraction of the cost. I don't know, but never mind. Anyway, moving on. And finally, the most significant event to happen to Edinburgh, happened in Edinburgh to date, was in 2019. Vin Diesel came to Edinburgh to film The Fast and the Furious 9. Woo! And
we love just, Vin.
Yeah, totally love that, Vin Diesel. So just to say, Vin Diesel, thank you very much for coming. You made me late for my bus numerous fucking times, you baldy bastard. But listen, don't worry about it. I'm sure when it comes out, it'll be a great movie. Not I'm going to fucking watch it, but yeah, good on you, mate. So, anyway, thank you very much. That is my
Cameron, that was amazing. Thank you so much. That was very informative in the way you kept all these, like, centuries and thousands of years. No, thousands of years, but centuries in, like, 30 minutes. That was amazing. Thank you very much. And may I say, I was surprised because you've said many wonderful things, but the fact that we've got a random street named Friedrich and Hanover in the middle of Edinburgh always baffled me, and you gave the perfect explanation. Thank you.
No worries, you're very welcome.
Now, let's move on to Becky for a bit of a favourite history of Edinburgh before we go to Kelly and the inaccurate history segment. Becky, on to you.
Thank you, Maria. I've kept this fairly short so that there wouldn't be any overlaps with other people or segments. But yeah, this is my 10 favourite facts about Edinburgh. I hope you like them. So, fact number one. Edinburgh was the first city in the world to have its own fire service, which was created in 1703. Unfortunately, however, it was a volunteer fire brigade. And because the firefighters had other day jobs, it took a lot of time to gather people when needed and for them to arrive at the burning place before it was too late. So they didn't always get there in time. Not ideal. Fact two. Edinburgh has more trees than any other city in the UK. There are 112 parks within the city limits itself. Factoid three. The city is built on 8 hills, and the rock on which the castle sits is the plug of an extinct volcano, which later, thanks to glacial erosion, formed a crag and a tail formation. This is now the Castle Rock and the Royal Mile. The last time the volcano erupted was 350 million years ago, though, so I think we're probably okay. Factoid 4, and my favourite one. The Edinburgh Seven were a group of female undergraduates at the University of Edinburgh, who were the very first group of female undergraduates in any British university. They began studying in 1869, and although they failed to graduate, their campaign garnered national attention, and legislation was enacted less than 10 years later to ensure that women could study in equal measure to men. Fact five, and this is just for Cameron because I know how much he loves it. Edinburgh hosted the 1972 Eurovision Song Contest after Morocco were unable to host it. Although it was a last-minute move to Edinburgh, the Scottish capital saw Luxembourg's Vicky Leandros win with the song Après Toi. Factoid number six. The Encyclopaedia Britannica was first produced and published in Edinburgh, and it was that first edition which caused controversy due to the anatomy section, which was said to contain unvarnished portrayals of the unmentionable parts of the human body.
That's beautiful. That's beautiful.
Fact number 7. Contrary to popular belief, Edinburgh's well-known nickname, Old Reeky, was not coined as a result of the stench of open sewers in medieval times, although that would have been absolutely gopping. In fact, Old Reeky refers to the smoke emitted by coal and wood burnt in the city's buildings and homes.
Yeah, I heard about that. And the only building, they did like a big programme where they cleaned the soot off all the buildings. So they've done, I can't remember when this was, but I know that they left the Scots Monument. Because they felt that it kind of gave the Scots Monument more of a like gothic kind of feel, but obviously the Scots Monument was never that black as what it is today, but that's like the one sort of remnant of the Old Reeky days is the Scots Monument. Fun fact.
Fact number 8. Obviously, we've all of us enjoyed wandering along Princes Street Gardens when it hasn't been destroyed by the Christmas market, although let's not go there. Princes Street Gardens was once a large body of water known as the, please forgive me, the Nor Loch. It was heavily polluted with sewage when it was still the Loch, and is thought to have been the location for around about 300 witch trials. Women and not a few men who were suspected of practicing witchcraft were cast into the depths, which would have been fetid. It would have been absolutely disgusting to determine their guilt. Now, their hands would have been bound and they would have been chucked into the water. And if the person could float, their fate was sealed and they were executed as witches. If they couldn't float, however, they were presumed innocent, which was all well and good, except they would have floated to the bottom and would have drowned. Hey. I know that when they drained the loch, when they were first doing the work of the creation of the new town, they found a significant number of bodies within the Nor Loch.
Science. That's all I can say. Science. It's true, you know. It's true, though. You know, it's like if a woman has a black cat, then she is definitely, you know, a witch, like 100%. You know what I mean? It's interesting to think that even like 500, 600 years ago, we were still throwing people into bodies of water to see if they would float to determine whether or not they practiced witchcraft, which, you know, I think we can all safely assume is a load of bollocks. This goes actually on to another point I'd like to make as well, actually, about the grass market. I mean, again, the grass market's also very famous, not as only as a slum as well, but it was also one of the focal points as well for executions in Edinburgh, typically hangings, etc. So there you go.
Have you heard about Half Hang at Maggie?
Yes.
I have indeed.
We love Half Hang at Maggie. Half Hang at Maggie was a lady from Musselburgh, I think she was from, and she was accused of killing her infant baby. I think that's what she was accused of. And they hanged her. Now, this was back in the days when it was like the long rope, rather. The short rope or the long, can't remember, the one that doesn't break your neck, basically, the one where you strangle to death. And so she was executed, she was hanged for however many minutes, she was then taken down, put in the coffin, and then on the cart back to Musselburgh, Maggie suddenly came to life again. And can you imagine being that man driving that cart? Anyway,
she came back to life.
Absolutely terrified. Like, it's a zombie, oh my god. But she came back to life. But this is interesting, because under Scots law, she had already been given the penalty for her crime. She'd already been executed. They couldn't execute her again. So she got let off, she was free, she went away and lived the rest of her life. And it was only after that point in Scots law did they add hanging until dead to the sentence because of Half Hang at Maggie. And there's now a pub in the grass market that's named after her. I think it's called, is it called Maggie Dixon's?
Maggie Dixon's,
yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, that's
the
one.
Tiny one, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
There's so many like fun wee stories like that for Edinburgh though, or in Edinburgh, should I say. So, yeah.
Fact number 9, and probably the cutest of all the facts here, is the legend of Greyfriars Bobby. Now, Greyfriars Bobby was a little terrier dog whose master was in the police and he died. And Greyfriars Bobby, loyal to the end, spent the next 14 years after his master's death next to his grave, pining for him. A year after Bobby died, a drinking fountain was built in Edinburgh to commemorate him. And really weirdly, people have a habit of rubbing his nose, and there is a sign next to the statue of Greyfriars Bobby, which says, please don't rub his nose, but people still ignore it, and there's loads of American, Canadian, Chinese, Australian tourists going, oh, look, it's the thing, and rubbing his nose and taking selfies and all that naff.
It's not as bad as the people that rub the guy's toe. Was it David? I don't know who it is, the statue that's outside the court where people, his toe, it's just his big toe.
Oh, yeah, that's weird.
Supposedly good luck. Like the people that spit on the Heart of Lothian.
Yeah, I did that.
Sir Giles. I did too.
But I think, Kelly, you do that for a different reason.
What? A different reason?
Well, yeah, you know, because...
Oh, I get you. I get you. Sorry, I'm a little bit slow today.
Sorry, Cameron, carry on.
Sorry, to be quite frankly honest, I think most people spit on the Heart of Midlothian, but yeah, I think that's for the same reason that Kelly does it, if I'm being perfectly honest. Like, whenever you walk through Gorgie, it's always advisable to have a... Excuse me. Whenever you walk through the wonderful part of Edinburgh called Gorgie, it's always advisable to have a peg over your nose due to the stench that kind of wafts from Tyne Castle. I just thought I would put that little bit of knowledge in there, you know, take what you want.
Thank you, Cam.
Fact 10 and my final factoid. Charles Dickens visited Scotland before he wrote A Christmas Carol, and when he was exploring the city, he came across the Canongate Kirk graveyard. When he was wandering around, he found an inscription on the gravestone of one Ebenezer Scroggie, which said Mealman in recognition of Mr. Scroggie's successful career as a corn trader. Now, Dickens misread this and thought it said Mean Man, and although he was absolutely horrified, this was the beginning of the legendary character of Ebenezer Scrooge. And I think that will do me. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Becky, for that. And that was really interesting. And now, due to the time restrictions, I'll swiftly pass on to Kelly.
No worries. I'll try and keep this kind of condensed. My little segment is going to be specifically about a part of area of Edinburgh called the Cowgate, or the Cowgate as it's known in Scots. The Cowgate was first recorded in 1428, and interestingly, so the name Cowgate comes from the medieval practice of herding cattle through streets, for the market, essentially at the weekends, which is where the name's derived from. But interestingly, in 1498, it was recorded with a different name. It was recorded with the same name, but in the same meaning, sorry, but it was in Latin, so it was called Via Vacorum. And I don't know, I think that sounds a bit cooler than Cowgate, but anyway. It means the exact same thing. I was kind of looking and I was like, oh, it'd be really cool if there was like a really swanky, like, fun, mysterious, like, meaning behind the name Via Vacorum, but it actually does mean, like, the streets through which you herd cattle. So I kind of left that one by the by. So, interestingly, in the 1500s, the Cowgate was considered one of the most prosperous parts of Edinburgh. And writer Alexander Eliseus described it as being at that time, quote, where the nobility and chief men of the borough reside. So it was very much an affluent area, which is quite interesting to bear in mind when we think about what Cammy had mentioned about it becoming a slum area in the 18th and 19th centuries, which we'll come on to in a wee bit. But interestingly, there is a chapel in the Cowgate, which is called the Magdalen Chapel, which was built in 1544. And at that time, at house, now this is an interesting fact, at house several poor men whose job was to pray for the soul of Mary, Queen of Scots. So this is when she was getting, well, sorry, she wasn't born in 1544, but when it was actually established in her later years, there was four men whose job it was to go in there and pray for her, which I thought was quite interesting. Also, the stained glass window, which is in this chapel, is the only pre-Reformation stained glass in Scotland, which is still in existence. So that is very, very old. But I'm not actually, I can't say I've actually seen it. I don't know if anyone's been to that chapel before.
Nope, no, I can't say I have.
Not me, no.
I've not been, so it's definitely on my list for whenever this lockdown ends. Swiftly moving on to the 18th and 19th centuries. By this time, the Cowgate had developed into a poor and overcrowded slum area, which became rife with brothels and illicit crime gangs. Now, interestingly... Interestingly, now this, I knew, I was like, at some point, I was so happy when I found this, because I was like, I'm going to just sneak the vaults in there somewhere, the Edinburgh vaults, which, if no one knows what the Edinburgh vaults are, who's listening, basically, they're part of the reason why Edinburgh gets known as one of the most haunted cities in Europe, because the vaults were essentially, the South Bridge vaults, which are the ones I'm specifically going to mention, were built after the construction of the new town. They were built underneath the South Bridge, which was finished in 1788, and it was originally built to be like storage tunnels, so places where businesses could store, like, you know, their casks of whiskey or whatever it was that they were making back then. But interestingly, it was only 7 years after the opening of the South Bridge that these vaults were already abandoned. And this is a really funny, well, it's not funny, a really very Edinburgh local superstition. So basically, the rumours were that the South Bridge was cursed. So the idea as to why this became cursed was because the first person who was due to cross over the South Bridge when it was opened was the wife of a really well-known Edinburgh judge. But she actually died just a couple of days before it opened. But the Edinburgh city officials felt, oh, you know what, we've kind of like promised her that she can, and we promised her and her husband that she'd be the first person to cross the bridge. So they still took her over the bridge, and she still was the first person to cross the bridge, but she was in her coffin when she crossed it. So basically the first person to cross the South Bridge was a dead person. And they believed that that then cursed the bridge and made it become essentially a centre for kind of supernatural and general bad vibes after that.
But surely, though, she would be more likely to haunt the bridge if they hadn't taken her across as the first person.
Well,
if
yeah.
Fulfilling her wishes, then surely she wouldn't haunt it.
Yeah, I don't know if they were even thinking about it just being her, or if it was just general, like, it was cursed because the first person to cross it was a dead person, and that was bad luck. Like, I don't really know their reasoning, but that was the local superstition, that the bridge was haunted. And basically, when the vaults had become abandoned, like the vaults underneath the South Bridge that businesses were using, the criminals and the poorest of society from the Cowgate slums started to move into the abandoned vaults as well, and that's where they formed a kind of sub-city, where they lived and died in poorly ventilated, damp and unsanitary conditions, with as much as 10 people crammed into one vault. And I don't know if anyone's been to the South Bridge vaults on like a ghost tour or whatever, but there's one room that you go into and they're so, so, so cramped. But there's a story that they tell you in one room where there was a fire, and they think that it was maybe set deliberately, but they don't know. But essentially a family was locked into a vault, and essentially there was a fire inside it. So they basically were baked to death, like they cooked to death inside this vault because it was stone. And there's a really, meant to be a really violent poltergeist in there. And when we were in there, I was getting really, really bad vibes. Like, I'm not saying I experienced anything, but there was some really bad vibes when you go down there. Like, it's just... Oh, and there's also, interestingly, one of them has been made into a Wicca temple now.
Really?
So, yeah. So if you go down... Yeah, so we got to see it. You can see that they've got their temple set up in one of the vaults, which is... Yeah, definitely, if you're going to choose a place. I mean, it's very... Yeah, there's bad juju down there, basically, is what I'm saying. But yeah, that was just a little bit, because most of the population that moved in there moved in from the Cowgate slums, so that's how I, you know, just needed to get in a wee tiny little bit about the Edinburgh vaults. But back to the Cowgate itself. So by the 18th century, Irish immigrants had begun to arrive in Edinburgh, where they were immediately treated with suspicion rather than being welcomed into the community, which led to the Cowgate becoming a ghetto for the Irish population and earned it the nickname Little Ireland. So by 1821, 12,000 Irish people lived in the Cowgate, and by 1841, it had risen to 16,000 in an Edinburgh population of 133,000. So that's quite a big proportion of the population were living just in one area in the Cowgate slum. By 1850, this population had begun to migrate to Leith with the expansion of the docks, and living conditions on the Cowgate were horrendous. Surveys in 1844 found that 40 of the lodging houses on the Cowgate had no basic living facilities, water or beds. So an interesting thing as well is Robert Louis Stevenson wrote about the differences between the new town and the old town in Edinburgh, and specifically the Cowgate, in his book Edinburgh Picturesque Notes. So this is what he said. He said, "I have mentioned already how to the stroller along Prince's Street, the High Street callously exhibits its back garrets. It is true there is a garden in between, and although nothing could be more glaring by way of contrast, sometimes the opposition is more immediate. Sometimes the thing lies in a nutshell, and there is not so much as a blade of grass between the rich and the poor. To look over the South Bridge and see the Cowgate below, full of crying hawkers, is to view one rank of society from another in the twinkling of an eye." So that's essentially what Robert Louis Stevenson wrote, and I thought that just kind of captured the entire the black and whiteness of society at that time. But back to the Cowgate itself, because there was no, so the Edinburgh local authorities didn't provide any assistance to the people living on the Cowgate. There was no kind of intervention, no financial support, nothing like that. They were kind of just essentially left to fend for themselves, like very much like a ghetto. And because of that, it wasn't until 1856 that a Catholic church was established for the community, and this was called St. Patrick's. And the money for St. Patrick's was raised half by the Catholic church and half by the local community, which really struck with me because these were the poorest of society. But they were so desperate to have a church that they raised half of it themselves. I just found that incredible. Like, they must have been so poor. So how they raised that, I don't know, but like, that's just, to me, is amazing, so big up to them. But the establishing of St. Patrick is really important as well because it led to the foundation, woo, of Hibernian FC, not that I'm biased, in 1875 by parishmen of St. Patrick's. And they remained based in the Cowgate until 1893 when they moved to Easter Road in Leith, which is where they are today. Interestingly, the three symbols on the Hibs badge mark the identity of the club's origins. So there is the castle for Edinburgh, there's the ship for Leith, and then there's the harp for Ireland, which is which denotes the club's roots. And the first manager of Hibs was a priest called Father Hannon, who lived in the Cowgate at that time. So just briefly, I just had a little bit about famous people who were born on the Cowgate. Interestingly, Walter Scott was born on the Cowgate, and this must have been, I think he was born in like 1771 and College Wynd, so that was maybe just before it started becoming slum areas, because I think Scott was quite middle class, but he was born there. And then also just a quick mention of a guy called James Connolly, who was born on the Cowgate in 1869 to Irish parents. He would later, he was a notable Hibs fan, but he would later become one of the key leaders of the Easter Rising in Ireland. He originally, ironically, served in the British Army, but this led to his lifelong hatred of them after witnessing their activity in Ireland during the land wars. And then he deserted his regiment when he learned that they were going to be transferred to India to do much of the same thing. So after he deserted the army, he then became involved in the Scottish Socialist Federation and then eventually the Irish Socialist Republican Party. He became, as I mentioned, one of the key leaders in the Easter Rising in 1916, which led to the Irish Free State. Following the Rising, he was sentenced to death, along with several other leaders, by firing squad in Dublin on the 12th of May 1916. But Connolly was actually so injured from the fighting at the time that he couldn't stand up, so he was strapped to a chair and executed in the jail against the wall. But the execution of Connolly and other Rising leaders was not well received worldwide at all, including in Britain. It was seen as particularly just not a good move for them to to make, essentially. And Herbert Asquith, the Prime Minister, ordered that there was no more executions of this kind to take place in Ireland for the leaders or for the from the resistance movement. He became a symbol for an independent Ireland and is commemorated by statues in Belfast and Dublin. And he came from the Cowgate. And that's all my quick summing up of the Cowgate.
Well, thank you very, very much. That was really interesting. And I feel like, although we did cover loads, Edinburgh is such a vast source of information that we could be speaking for hours. But thank you so much, everyone, for your thorough research. That was really good and enlightening. And before we go on to the quiz, I would like to ask you, since we've all met in Edinburgh and we work in Edinburgh, and we spend a big part of our lives in Edinburgh, even though, you know, me and Kelly live here, but you and Cameron, and Becky and Cameron, sorry, live a bit further out. What is it that you love about Edinburgh in a nutshell? Becky, do you want to start?
So, clearly I'm not Scottish. But the thing that I love most about Edinburgh is I do actually have a slight familial connection to it. When I was first deciding where I wanted to go to university, and I kind of broached the subject of moving up to Scotland to go to university, my mum had a bit of a freak out, and she immediately called up my grandparents, and my granddad was like, well, actually, I was based in Edinburgh in the 60s, and I just thought that was absolutely brilliant because I never knew that part of my granddad's life, and he was based at Edinburgh Castle. He has two favourite stories that he liked to talk about when he talked about Edinburgh. And the first was his quarters were next to the bagpipe school in the castle. And to the day he died, whenever he heard bagpipes, he would start to cringe, remembering all of the pipers that were learning the trade. He hated them passionately ever since that time. And the other thing was, he was, during the 60s, the SNP did a big push, and he joined the SNP because they were giving out free beer. And he, again, to the day that he died, he had his SNP membership card in his wallet because he thought it was really funny. Probably not as funny to people who do take it seriously, but he was very mischievous. So that whenever I go to Edinburgh and I look up the castle, I do think of my granddad. So yeah, that's me.
That is so emotionally moving. I love this. And I love the fact that he had the SNP card in his wallet. And that was really cheeky. I quite like it. Thank you very much, Becky. Kelly?
I think that's pretty much, ironically, it's kind of the same as Becky, I think, because I was obviously born in Edinburgh. My family were born in Edinburgh, at least on one side. So a lot of kind of family stories and family connections and things. So I've heard, like, my granddad, when he was a wee boy, lived in the High Street. And interestingly, that was in the 1930s, and it was still very, very poor. I mean, it wasn't quite slums, but it was definitely the poorest district in Edinburgh. And so he had loads of stories, just in terms of, like, back in the day, they used to hang their washing out in the High Street. So they used to, and can you imagine the Royal Mail, as tourists know it now, with just washing hanging from side to side all the way up. But they used to do that, and my granddad used to, or he said to his wee sister, to climb over the washing line. This is the story goes. There's loads of family stories, and the story goes that his mum was walking up the High Street, having got her messages, and she looked up, and her wee girl was like crawling along the washing line. And they lived up a close, like they lived in a tenement, which was in like whatever floor. And yeah, because my granddad, like, much like what you were saying, Becky, he was quite mischievous and he did stuff like that. And then also my great granddad was in jail at Edinburgh Castle, and there's like a family story about him like scaling down the crags to like escape. And yeah, there's just so many like family kind of stories that are connected to it for me. And then also the fact it is just, I mean, and not to be biased, it is just so stunningly beautiful. Like, there's nowhere quite like it. Like, I've been to, like, a few places, and you'll never find anywhere quite like Edinburgh.
It is beautiful. I agree.
I couldn't agree more. And I love the fact that your granddad, not that he was jailed, but that he was in the Edinburgh Castle great-granddad. Like, this is so such a cool story to pass on to your family. That is just unbelievably cool. Well done. Cameron?
So I think for myself, the reason why I love Edinburgh is because it's home. I was born there. I spent a large part of my life there. And I've moved around quite a bit as well, to be fair. But it's just, for me, Edinburgh has always been that kind of like captivating capital. I mean, it's so rich and full of history. It's got quite a vibrant culture. I mean, it's I love it. It's my city, and I love it. That's it, basically.
Thank you very much, Cameron. For me, I was conditioned to love anything Scottish from a Scottish teacher who I met when I was nine, and she taught me English. And then I came here at 15 to do a summer school for English, and I just fell in love with it. And I know it's a bit cringy and cliche, but it felt like home immediately. And because I came here when I did my master's for the first time, and I felt like sort of like the just before I became an adult, Edinburgh feels like the place where magic happens. For me, it's full of like fireworks and beauty, and it's where I came to be me, and I felt free for the first time in my life, because that was the time that I actually chose my friendships, chose the people I want to, call family now. And essentially, it's as for a foreigner, it immediately felt like home. So that was my soapy reason why I love Edinburgh so much. Again, thank you very much, everyone, for your contribution to this amazing podcast. Now we move on swiftly to the historical fact of the day, and it's very, 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 very swift one. The same day back in 1606, the 12th of April, as it is today, it was when England decided to adopt the Union Jack as its flag. So that was a very quick fact of the day. And now we can move on to the quiz. So for the quiz of the day, I've got 10 questions. I'll ask the questions, and then whoever gets the answer first wins the point. Ready to go?
Yep.
Okay,
Yeah.
number one. So, number one, the Scott Monument is named after.
So Walter Scott.
Well done, Becky. Which European city is Edinburgh most often compared to?
Athens.
Well
Athens.
done, Kelly. What time does the 1 o'clock gun
1 o'clock.
fire on a Sunday?
Oh.
I
Quarter
feel
past
like you
three.
should know this.
One, I'm gonna go with 1 o'clock.
Is that your final answer, guys?
Yes.
Well, it
Yeah.
doesn't fire on a Sunday. Thank you.
Oh,
That
Dominic.
was good. Number four. Name the detective in the novel set in Edinburgh by Ian Rankin.
Rebus.
Yes. Was that Kelly? Number five. Which Scottish region is Edinburgh part of?
Lothians.
Lothian.
Well done, Becky. Number six. What is the Gaelic form of Edinburgh's name?
Dunedin?
Yes, Becky. Come on. Right.
Okay, I could have
Listen,
said
I
that
think
sooner,
there's some
but
interference or something like that. Because every time I speak, it like is like a delay or something like that.
okay, let's
Okay,
test number seven.
that's my
What
excuse.
is Edinburgh's nickname?
Old
Old
Reekie.
Reekie.
Sorry, Cameron. Girls, well done. Number eight, Prince Street Gardens used to be a what?
Lock.
Lock.
Can I give this to Cameron? Is that okay?
Yes.
Thank you.
No, it's fine. Don't worry about it.
Okay. Number nine. The French Festival started during which decade?
40s.
1947.
Wow. That goes. I'll give it to Cameron and Kelly. And number 10. What is the approximate population of Edinburgh today?
Five,
Oh.
just
Half a
over 5 million.
million?
Okay, I'll give this to Cameron. He was the most fervent one.
Yes.
So. There we go. I think it's a tie between the girls and then Cameron. You came second. That's amazing. Well, thank you
Thank
very
you.
much for everything. That was another episode in the wonderfully Historical Inaccuracies podcast. Thank you for tuning in, and see you next week, guys.
Thank you. See you next week.
Bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.